You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
It's me again, Tamara, your host and serious coffee lover. Actually, you don't want to know me without it. It's kind of not pretty. So, you know what I'm sick of? Information. I know, there, I said it. I feel like I am constantly swimming in a sea of information overload, and my head is barely able to just even be above water as I try to figure out what matters and what's just noise. Are you with me? Well, as today's guest, Zach First, talks about, information is like calories, and most of us are suffering from information obesity right now. Zach is actually the executive director of the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University. So that was obviously founded by the management guru, Peter Drucker, and their whole mission is to strengthen organizations, to strengthen society. They do amazing work. So I found our conversation about strategic optimists versus defensive pessimists fascinating. Can you guess which one I am? Yeah, it's probably pretty obvious, right? Strategic optimist. I think it will shed a lot of light on the people you work with and how to leverage them all of them, because we need them all. And he talks a lot about how organizations are like the body, and you can't just have one part working while the rest is failing you. So interesting. Now, to no surprise, Zach's innovator archetype, so how he naturally innovates, is an instinctual risk taker, which means that he fully taps into his work. You should really see it. You'll hear it all through it and listen for the language he uses around holistic measurements. That's an instinctual all the way, you know, working to connect the dots and see the patterns. And his risk taker comes out when you hear him talk about some of his more controversial stance on things, his willingness to be uncomfortable, because that's what being a risk taker is all about. All right, it's time to dig in. Zach, I'm so excited for today's conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tamara. It's a real pleasure.
Well, since we don't know each other yet, what's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Depends how well you know me, but potentially the fact that I really love singing in a church choir.
Oh, and what do you love about it, can I ask?
For sure. I spend a lot of my professional life working on problems that we view as having solutions, where extra effort is often viewed as kind of vital to getting to those solutions. I serve in a leadership position, so I'm often out front, whether literally in front of rooms or in front of my team. And when you're making music with a large group of people, none of those things apply.
It's like the exact opposite of what you have to do all day.
It is, and it's actually really refreshing for that reason.
Yeah.
So in fact, in some ways, the harder you try, the worse you sound. The more you stand out, the worse the music is.
Oh.
And the end goal is not to produce the perfect piece of music or to solve some kind of problem. That is going to mean whatever it means to the people who are in the pews.
You know,
so it's a really different way of being, and I find that just incredibly refreshing and restorative, actually.
I can totally see that, and I feel like some of the things you just said would make the best Instagram memes ever, but we'll move past that. And I feel like it's a really good segue into, tell us a little bit about the mission of the Drucker Institute and what you do there so we have context to where you're coming from.
Sure. So the Drucker Institute is based at Claremont Graduate University in suburban Los Angeles. Our mission is strengthening organizations to strengthen society. And that's a mission that is built directly on the spirit and emphasis of Peter Drucker's 60 plus years of work. He's widely regarded as the father of modern management and almost literally the inventor of the discipline of management, the integrator of all these disparate things that we think of as being parts of management. But for Drucker, he didn't devote his life to that work because he was a big fan of management, or even because he was a fan of organizations per se. He was a fan of humanity. He called himself a social ecologist. He loved society and people. And what he witnessed through the 1930s in Central Europe, through the rise of the fascists in Italy and Germany, and the banning and burning of his own writings by the Nazis in Austria was, in his diagnosis, what happens when management fails to perform. And so he dedicated the rest of his life to trying to help management be both responsible and performing in all sectors of society. So that means business, but also nonprofits and government. Because in his view, management was nothing less than the bulwark against tyranny. And so for us, as the inheritors of his legacy, you know, we certainly hope every organization we work with becomes more effective. And in some ways, that's all they really need to care about. But if we help them become effective in the right ways, they also contribute to the strength of our society and to keeping tyranny at bay for a little bit longer.
What a wonderful reminder. I think we sometimes forget that an organization is simply made up of people.
Yeah, exactly. So Drucker has this great story about when he was in his 20s, one of his first jobs, he was working as an investment banker actually in London. And he used to take the train out to Cambridge to go listen to these weekly lectures by the great economist John Maynard Keynes. And he recalled sitting in the back of the lecture hall listening to this this man talk, and said it just dawned on him, everyone who's here cares primarily about the behavior of commodities, and I actually care about the behavior of people.
Mm.
And for him, that was the difference between management and economics. Although, of course, as we've seen lately, economics has moved very much in that direction as well.
That's right. So I want to kind of dig a little bit into the business landscape, which I think ultimately, I love this foundation now, the people landscape of today.
Yeah.
So describe how you see today's business landscape.
Yeah, so people may have seen a really good window into how we at the Institute are thinking about this right now. The first week in December 2017 was when we ran, in partnership with the Wall Street Journal, this first annual management top 250 ranking in a special section that covered some years of research we've done that's now seeing the light of day around what it means quantitatively to be an effective company. And there's a lot baked into just that one sentence, so we just unpack that quickly. First is, you know, Peter Drucker was really a journalist in his method. He was an observer and a writer of stories and a reporter of what we now think of as cases. And he was incredibly powerful in his capacity to uncover these kind of timeless truths about management and human beings. But in today's era, two things are true that mean we have to refresh these timeless truths. One is management is just a very probably second to like pop music. It's obsessed with the latest.
Yeah, that's so true.
And so on some level, there are other cultures, Japan in particular, where the older the idea in management, in some ways, the better. They view it as being time-tested and therefore a little more trustworthy. But here in the States and in some other Western countries in particular, we love the new thing. So that's one, is we've got to just, like the old cornflake slogan, we've got to help people experience something again for the first time. And then the second thing is the world is just a lot more numerical than it was, let's say, 50 years ago. We expect to see things counted and quantified. Not everything that matters can be counted or quantified, but we know we've got to do our best effort to meet business where it is today. And that means in the form of metrics, in the form of transparent, reliable data. And then where we aim to kind of change the way business leaders are thinking about or understanding things is to present for them a holistic measure of how the company is doing. And so much of what we see in business today are incredible depth and strength within any given vertical, incredible depth and strength of knowledge, everything you could possibly want to know about innovation and how to innovate, with tremendously weak linkages in understanding to the other functional areas of the company. So do we have any idea what the role of human resources is in spurring innovation? A few companies do, but most don't.
Yeah.
And so part of what we aim to do is present the whole picture in a way that, as Drucker said, is sort of the view of the general practitioner in a world that so often is loaded with specialists. And that's, I think, probably the biggest contribution we can make to business today, is to refresh and recapture really the value of that holistic view.
I have a couple questions for you I want to dig in on. So the first one is, I want to go back to the whole numerical thing and the metrics. And I love metrics. I love to understand where we are. I love to understand where we're headed and progress. One of the things I've experienced, and a lot of, I think, the launch streeters out there will tell you, is sometimes they over focus on a lot of different metrics and then they drown in it. And they don't necessarily know which metrics to really focus on, the ones that are going to move the needle. How do you think about the right metrics to pay attention to versus all the metrics?
Yeah, it's a great question. A couple of rules of thumb to start with. One, we can go to Peter Drucker's wife of more than 70 years, Doris, who was really a remarkable woman in her own right. She was an inventor, an entrepreneur, a physicist, editor of many of his books, and a real collaborator intellectually with him. Doris, we knew well. She was on our board at the Drucker Institute for many years. She had a phrase she used to use called information obesity.
Yeah.
And it's a great way to think about, you know, if we monitored information like calories, we'd be a lot more careful about how much of it and what kind of it we consume. So that's one just to be aware of. The second thing is my favorite misquotation of Peter Drucker, and there are a lot of them. You find all kinds of things attributed to him just because they sound snappy and kind of wise, and so people assume maybe he said them. There's a wonderful misquotation of his that you can find all over the place, which is, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it.
Yeah. I've seen it painted on walls.
Yeah, exactly. Now, here's the thing about that. First of all, what he wrote was, what gets measured gets managed.
Yeah.
So the first thing that tells us is, let's be both respectful of but also cautious with numbers. Because if we measure the wrong thing, it's going to be very hard to not manage to that, even
right.
if it's the wrong thing, because we measure it. The second thing we know is, of course it's not true that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. I mean, anyone who has either successfully managed or mismanaged a romantic relationship knows all kinds of stuff that you can't measure is vital.
That is true.
Enterprise. So we know that, we know that sort of intuitively that's not right. So what we want to think about is, let's watch out for information obesity. Don't just vacuum up all the data you can, because it'll bog you down. Second, be careful about what you measure, because it's going to lead to what you manage. So then that leads us to kind of the third principle, which is, make sure that what you're measuring and managing to is directly connected to the results you're trying to achieve. We can look outside business for just an interesting example. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago for Harvard Business Review on, it was called What to Measure If You're Mission Driven. And that's increasingly true for business today. I think they understand the importance of mission. But in this case, it's about a large Episcopal congregation that's here in Los Angeles that was wrestling with the question of whether they should continue to track membership. It's one of the oldest things that churches do, track membership. But the truth is, membership has very little correlation to the financial bottom line, to how much money they raise. And it also has absolutely no correlation to mission, because the goal of the church is not to create members. It's to inspire people to go follow the teachings of Jesus. And you don't have to be a member to do that. So you can analogize to your own business and say, well, there are plenty of things we measure that have nothing to do with whatever the relationship is we're trying to establish with our customers. And in that sense, you want to be careful and about what you measure and track. And we are awash to just so many places you can track all manner of metrics. I mean, we can kind of fall into a hole if we're not careful around just the latest, social media dashboard, right? And on and on. What's the actual change you're trying to produce in your customer's life? And how do you best get at that? And the odds are good that the metrics will be a little messy. They'll be a little imperfect. And if they are, that probably tells you you're on the right track, because you're trying to measure human beings and they're tricky to measure.
Yeah, we are a little tricky that way.
Yeah.
I really like what you said, though, and launch streeters out there listening, I would encourage you to really pause and think about information like calories. That is so great, because really you only want a certain amount. And I think, Zach, to what you're saying is so important, which is, what type of calories you take in matter too. So you got to make sure you're tracking the right ones. And I know that I have been guilty of tracking ones that looked really sexy, but didn't actually produce anything either way. And unfortunately, I think to your point, that put me and my team down a rabbit hole of making decisions on that, which actually detracted from the results we were actually trying to achieve with the business.
Yeah, there's a great phrase from a member of our board, Jocelyn Wyatt, who runs and co-founded IDEO.org, which is their social sector focused arm. And Jocelyn talks about vanity numbers.
Yeah.
And there are, we have them, we're as guilty of them as the rest of the world. Those numbers that, as you say, you look at and you say, boy, that's sexy. And geez, if only we had X number of Twitter followers, or if we had X number of applicants for that program, or whatever it is. And the truth is, it's a pretty tenuous link between vanity numbers and results almost always.
Yeah.
And in some cases, some of the hardest choices we've had to make are to say, you know, the number of people who are actually going to be affected in a meaningful way by this program is really small. And that's okay. What if we reoriented all our work around really touching deeply those few organizations? It's a humbling experience and it's a little scary, but it also is incredibly clarifying. And in fact, usually it works.
Well, it makes me really question how many of us are measuring the wrong things, or I don't say wrong, measuring the least effective things that don't get us to where we're trying to go. I want to flip it for a second. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was the silos and how, you know, how does HR contribute to innovation? How does accounting contribute to innovation? I mean, I think we know, you know, marketing, branding, R&D, innovation teams do. And, you know, one of the things that we at LaunchStreet really try to share is that everybody is responsible and accountable and has a part in contributing to innovation. It's why we created the Innovation Quotient Edge assessment, the one that you took, which I think you are a risk taker instinctual, which is fascinating to hear your language, by the way, because it's so great to like he's hearing it in action. But, you know, because we wanted everybody to recognize, hey, actually, I can be a part of this. I'd love to hear it from your perspective, because you had mentioned that challenge before of silos, kind of what the challenge is there and how do we overcome it?
Yeah. So, you know, it's helpful. We've learned a lot from Peter Drucker and just the way that he thought about things. One of the things he often did was analogize management problems to the human body. So you get data as calories. Another thing you can get is to think about the different functional areas of an organization as different parts of the human body. And, you know, operations and logistics is maybe the muscles and so on. And what you quickly see is the typical approach to a lot of management issues is to try to produce a higher performance human being by really optimizing the knee joint, which, sure, you know, if everything else is maximally optimized, it's not a bad idea.
Right.
But odds are most of the time you're dealing with someone who's got a, you know, stiff lower back and they're a little overweight and, you know, maybe they got flat feet and they need glasses and you're worrying about them. And you're worried about.
Are you looking at my picture?
Right. Yeah, no, I'm painting a self-portrait. So, and maybe, you know, and why are we worrying about the knee joint?
Right.
It just doesn't.
And who cares if it's optimized if nothing else is working?
That's exactly right. And so, you know, innovation is one of those things that I think, in our view at the Drucker Institute, innovation is not the province of the brilliant inventor or, you know, the one or two mostly guys in the garage. It is something that is more properly thought of as systematic, as a discipline that can be practiced throughout the organization. Most of your innovative opportunities are actually not explicitly in products and services. They're in the way that you work, the kinds of opportunities you seek out, the levels of the organization that you engage in innovation. Are you able to effectively draw ideas from the front lines of the organization back into the C-suite and so on? And in that sense, you know, if we look at, as a lot of organizations today want to do, if we look at innovation as kind of the beating heart of the enterprise, well, then you want to say, well, every part of this enterprise should be connected to that, rather than just, you know, our ideation center that sits kind of adjacent to the corporate headquarters. Every part of the innovation of the organization should be innovating. All of our people should be engaged in it. And in some ways, innovation in the accounting procedures can actually have more impact on the bottom line than the new product or service. And that requires embracing kind of the full humanity of all the people who are engaged in the organization. It's the old problem with Henry Ford, you know, he used to say, I just want a pair of hands. And unfortunately I get the head attached when I hire these people. So we have a lot of that in today's organization too. You know, people are kind of viewed as a cost rather than an asset and they're a little annoying. You know, they take sick days and they complain about leadership and they kind of do all this stuff that feels like it's a distraction. But, those are just symptoms of the larger opportunity, actually, which is you've got all these thoughtful, committed human beings running around ready to contribute meaning and purpose to your organization. May as well engage them.
You know, it's interesting. I was recently in San Diego. I spoke for one of the largest customer care associations. So all the people in the room are customer care from various companies, everything from, you know, Nike over to ones we've never heard of in manufacturing.
Yeah.
And what was so fascinating to me, and it kind of resonates with what you said, is that these are people who are on the front lines of these brands every single day. And they're having these conversations with the customers. They are engaged. They're the ones really sharing the voice of the brand, whether that's solving problems or pointing them in the right direction. What's interesting to me is that they're also thought of as a cost center. And not part always. Some of the organizations get it right, and I'm not throwing anyone in particular under the bus here. But many of them see it as a cost center and not, to your point, as, wow, we've got all of these people in our organization who have probably all these ideas or at least all of this insight into what's happening that we can pull ideas from.
Yeah.
And it's really unfortunate because I think that in a lot of ways that really hinders the total organization's ability to innovate. And oh my gosh, what a missed opportunity.
Yeah. And look, it's a really complicated problem, too. I mean, once you start to pull on this thread, things get both a lot more interesting and a lot trickier at the same time. So I have a colleague, a member of my team, and our former executive director, Rick Wartzman, who writes a column for Fast Company. And about 2 months ago, he wrote a piece on this question of treating employees as assets. And there have been some motions over the years, actually in the accounting community, to try to do that. And of course, everything is interconnected. So immediately you see, well, we have a problem, which is if we as a corporation spend money on training and development, that's viewed as a cost. And we don't have any way to show that as an asset. Now we have better people. We can't show it as an asset on our balance sheet. So then there's some effort to say, well, here are some ways you could do that. But of course, then the moment that employee walks out the door, now you just lost assets off your balance sheet. So then it calls into question, well, how long-term a relationship are we looking for with our people? The answer to that question is, over time, less and less.
Yeah.
Everything's become a bit more mercenary. There's been, as my colleague Rick's latest book puts it, there's been the end of loyalty over the last 20 years. So when that happens, now there's a little kind of a – there's a bit of a standoff between employees and employers around this. And it's to everyone's detriment, actually. We all lose when that happens.
Yeah, it's a shame. I think that lack of loyalty goes both ways. I think companies also show lack of loyalty. Some people show lack of loyalty back. It's this horrible virtuous cycle that keeps going on and on. I wanted to ask you about an article that you wrote that really caught my attention, and that was Rethinking the Corporate Love Affair with Change. Mm. And it partially caught my attention because, you know, I think especially in the innovation space, it's all about you must change. Like that's kind of the narrative that we're working towards. So tell me a little bit about, from your perspective, why we need to rethink our view on change. I want to share that with the audience.
Yeah, sure. So again, you know, it won't surprise you at this point to know this all comes back to the human being. Organizations are themselves not capable of thought or action. It's a legal structure that organizes people. And people, by and large, don't change. If you think about the human operating system, as a colleague of mine put it, that doesn't get upgraded regularly. Maybe it's upgraded slowly over the course of tens of thousands of years. But the brains, the neurology, the physical systems that we have as people to exist within organizations are not changing. And so we know that there are certain immutable truths about the speed at which human beings just emotionally, spiritually, psychologically can adapt to change. We know that there is great value in continuity as we form really powerful, valuable forces like culture and tradition, these things that actually hold organizations together. And in fact, it's in the very purpose of an organization to resist change, which is to say to be resilient.
Right.
I mean, the flip side of change is just resilience. And we think about the flip side of change as being resistance to change, which just sounds like you're a stick in the mud.
Right.
But the flip side, I think you can also fairly say, is resilience. It's an ability to hold fast amidst turbulence, and that's a valuable thing. So what all that means, I think, is we've got to temper how we think about change, particularly in large organizations. Certain things should probably be in a constant state of flux. Certainly, when you look at just the pace of technology these days and the way in which it's permeating every aspect of the organization, yeah, don't fall behind on that. Let's not be resistant to change in that area. But let's not fall in love with this idea that because technology is changing quickly, everything else ought to be changing quickly as well. You know, let's have a giant sort of blue sky reorg of our work processes every 18 to 24 months. You're going to drive your people nuts.
Yeah.
And they're going to spend all their time thinking about how they work rather than just doing their work.
Yeah.
And so there are endless optimizations we can go through, each one of which carries a cost. People have to learn, they have to adjust, they have to go through periods of anxiety and fear. And then they can maybe, if you do it all right, kind of get comfortable and get back to being productive again. You're going to put people through that cycle. You better be really sure it's worth it. So the thrust of that piece was to consider the human being first and understand that that's actually the essential technology of the organization. It isn't upgraded regularly. The hardware doesn't change. And then to build your pace of change around that. So if you have areas in which you're going to ask people to be relentless about their embrace of change, and every organization probably does these days, you ought also to balance those with areas in which there is no change so that people have some solid ground they can stand on while they're, you know, swinging and flailing at all the, you know, the everything that's flying at them.
That's in this other domain. That's a really it's a really interesting way to kind of balance the need for both, for a little bit of consistency and to keep up with changing times. Do you think a couple things? One, do you think that we get into this cycle of chasing change that doesn't actually matter, almost a little bit like the metrics? I hear it a lot in technology, but I think it's true in a lot of ways. Oh, this customer expectation changed. Oh, this technology changed. Oh, the competition changed. So we're constantly chasing it, trying to figure out what matters, what doesn't matter, what we need to do something about. And that feels exhausting. Actually, let's start there. Talk a little bit about that. Like, are we chasing too much?
Yeah, absolutely. The most compelling work that I think any organization can do is going to be born out of an authentic sense of purpose that is unique to that organization, an authentic relationship with its customers that is probably also unique to that organization. And when you find yourself chasing other things from outside the organization, you know, each one of those is going to come in some ways as almost like an organ transplant. And you don't want to be constantly swapping your organs.
Right. Once just, is probably good.
You know, have access to some that work a little bit better than the ones that you currently have. So again, there's the sense, I think, of we've kind of technologized the way in which we think about human organizations. And we imagine that because technology is constantly upgradable and constantly evolving and getting ever faster and more powerful, that our organizations should be as well. And to some extent, that's true. We never want to stop striving for excellence and improving our performance. But the pace is radically different, and human beings' ability to absorb change is radically different. So don't imagine just because you get a new phone every 12 months that, yeah, you also want to be upgrading your CRM every 12 months.
Right.
You'll drive your salespeople nuts. So, yeah, I think just the technologization, if we can pull that back and actually re-anthropomorphize the way in which we look at things, it's a lot healthier. It also means you spend a lot more time thinking about what's unique about your organization, what you do uniquely well, because while you're chasing the competition, they're probably chasing you too. And in fact, to be different is probably the most powerful strategic tool you've got these days. There's just tremendous opportunity in standing out and having a unique and distinctive voice and offering. But it requires courage. You know, that was one of Drucker's core principles. The first thing you ought to pay attention to as an executive is courage. And the second thing you ought to pay attention to is analysis. And we often get that backwards. We flip it around and say, begin with the thing you actually have guts to do, because change is hard.
Yeah.
And then once you figure out if you have guts to do it, then you can ask yourself if it's the smart thing to do.
You know, I really appreciate, too, your comment about it's more important to focus on being different, what makes you unique, the core. I think, you know, better, stronger, faster. The challenge, as you said, about chasing each other is I could be a little bit faster today, but then you can come in and be a little bit faster than my faster. And then I'm going to try to be a little bit faster than your faster. And it's just this, what's that old Dr. Seuss, like the bee watch watcher watching the bee or something, whatever that book. I love Dr. Seuss, but I'm getting the quote wrong, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I want to bring it back into the people and kind of what you've been talking about, because I love this juxtaposition of change and consistency, yet how it all works together. And, you know, to your kind of entire foundation, to this conversation of the Drucker Institute, it really is about the people. So if I'm leading, if I'm managing, I've got people who love change, seek it out, thrive in it. And then I've got people who really actively resist it. And neither is, well, actually, you tell me. I mean, is one right or wrong, A? And then B, how do we manage to all those perspectives that we have inside our organization?
Yeah, great, great question. We had a former colleague at the Drucker Institute who's now gone into full-time work as an executive coach, who taught all of us this kind of wonderful framing, which we kind of laugh about. It's a little too powerful sometimes for everybody who's involved, which is that, again, like so many typologies, it's probably a bit of an oversimplification, but you'd say on balance, most people most of the time fall into one of two camps. They are either strategic optimists, so they're seeking out differentiation, new opportunities, and they're convinced that they can find wonderful, exciting ways to make all these new ideas work. And you have defensive pessimists, and they are trying to protect the core, ensure the integrity of the organization, and they're always on the lookout for threats. And I'm a strategic optimist. One of the people on my staff who I collaborate with the most often is a defensive pessimist. Mm. And it's in the combination of the two that you actually get great work done. Too many people like me will actually create a lot of risks for the organization and will accelerate the pace of change to the point where it's a real drag on people's ability to do work. Too many defensive pessimists and you get stuck.
Yeah.
Because everything carries risks. And at some point, you know, you're not able to embrace the risk and you wind up in a permanently defensive crouch. The integration of the two is actually quite powerful because you get a nice kind of left foot, right foot rhythm that can happen where I can come in and stir something up and say, you know, what if we looked at things this way? What if we tried to approach it differently? The defensive pessimist can say, well, are you really sure? What are the risks it's going to create? What haven't we thought through about this? I think, oh yeah, that's a good question. I go back and I can say, okay, we'll look at it this way. And you could sort of ping pong back and forth and you get to good results. Drucker had a rule of thumb. If there's anything that's happening as a decision inside an organization that's important and you don't have vigorous disagreement over it, yeah, you haven't actually thought it through. And so in that sense, it's in that, I think it was Thomas Jefferson who called it the fierce clash of ideas. That is what you're looking for. And so in that sense, you want a balance of people who love change and people who understand the cost of change and are worried about it. You want them actually working side by side.
So how do you start that? Because one of the things you probably see this too, that I see is, I think it's a myth we have, particularly in innovation, where we're trying to, you know, come up with new ideas and new way. Like you said, though, I believe very strongly it's about the process of, you know, how you solve the problems, how you look at them, see opportunities, do things differently. But I think we have this, you know, myth that the yes anders, those people, like, yeah, and I'm an optimist, a strategic optimist, yeah, I'm totally like you, like, we get it, we're visionary, oh my God, we're totally on board, we're the innovative, yeah, ones. And then the yes butters are the people who don't get it and they should just be ignored because those people are just not on your bandwagon. Mm. How do you start that process of getting that ping pong, as you said, to work?
Yeah, there's some great writing by other folks out there who've done some good thinking on this. So I'll just draw on some of their work. Roger Martin's a favorite of ours at the Drucker Institute. He's got a new book out recently called Creating Great Choices that touches on a lot of this. The folks at the Stanford Design School and at IDEO have produced a lot of great materials around design thinking. I'll just tell you, for me and my team, one of the practices we've adopted from outside that we've learned from others is when we're trying to bring these different kinds of people together, is to begin with an assignment that says we want to produce, let's say it's a new program or a new service. We know this is in some ways going to require some real open-mindedness, kind of radical innovation. The assignment we give ourselves is, let's come up with as many ideas as we have the energy to go test. So we don't want a long list. Maybe it's 3 or 4 or 5. And then the assignment is to try to make every one of those ideas fail.
Mm. And so you're looking for the holes.
We look for the holes. And the only way that we will let ourselves make an idea fail is if a potential customer makes it fail. So then we immediately get outside the organization and you start talking to people and you start testing ideas often, you know, the earliest ones you want to do with the people who are kind of most trusted and closest to you. Sometimes, you know, you can work with board members or others who are kind of sit on the boundary of the organization. Try to make it fail. The defensive pessimists love that part of the exercise. And the strategic optimists can get into it because they know that on the other side of that is if you fail to fail, then actually you get to keep going. And the idea that stands, the service that we actually launch, is the one that has just failed to fail the most.
Wow, that is so good. Oh my gosh, launch readers out there, think about, I would pause it, rewind, and listen to exactly what Zach just said again, because that was so good about how to bring those two together. As the president of my company, I'm that strategic optimist, and I have defensive pessimists with me. And I do find myself sometimes when we get in the conversations about things that I want to try of being like, wah, wah, where you're right. I think the power's in bringing both together. I'm curious, and maybe you have an example from the Management Top 250 in the Wall Street Journal, that project that you just launched. Is there a case study or a story that you can share of a management team, a company that you think is just crushing it with all these things we just talked about?
Yeah, great question. And it's one of the things I really love about this ranking is that there's two very different ways to look at that. If you look just in our top 10, you'll see the number one company in this year's ranking is Amazon. And the reason that Amazon is ranked at number one and is not because in all five of the dimensions of corporate performance that we look at, that Amazon is just crushing it across the board. Amazon's doing pretty well in some of those dimensions. They're doing actually not so well in others, particularly social responsibility. But they are playing in a different league, even from the very best tech companies in innovation. And they are so off the charts in that rating that it pulled them into the number one spot. You can look just a few places down the list, tied for number six is Procter & Gamble. And Procter & Gamble is a company that is demonstrating, it's one of only six companies in our entire ranking that demonstrates excellence on every measure. And those are two very different models. And two very different ways of looking at what it means to be crushing it. And so you can look at Amazon. The Journal did a really nice story about kind of what the day-to-day innovation techniques are at Amazon, the two pizza meetings and all that kind of stuff. And you can see what they wrote up about how Amazon is relentless about innovation. They focus on it. They put all their energy and resources into it, and they get a great result. And you can look at Procter & Gamble, which takes a systematic approach to just about everything that they do. And they did a great write-up on them, and I think Walmart also, and how they're trying to better integrate tech companies' innovation techniques into what we'd often view, I think, unfairly from the outside as these kind of fusty old, you know, retail brick and mortar diapers and toilet paper organizations.
My cleaning products.
They're actually quite sophisticated, but they're pushing themselves in the same ways to integrate a lot of these tech company style innovation techniques. What's crucial about as we think of kind of the all-stars, these companies that are just crushing it across the board are doing, is they are able to maintain a focus on all five of the areas that we measure. They're companies that are strong in their sense of mission, purpose, social responsibility. They spend a lot of time and energy in a smart way, engaging and developing their employees. They are relentlessly focused on the customer. Customer's boss, they're number one. They are high performers at innovation, and when you put the whole package together, they have a strong financial strength as well.
You know, I also think what's interesting about, I'm going to use Amazon in particular, and it loops back to what you said earlier about know your core, know what makes you unique. I did a whole video blog on this. I feel silly saying vlog, so I just have to say video blog. I know that it's dating myself, but there it is. You know, they are brilliant at knowing who they are in their core. They know what they're about. And when they bought Whole Foods, a lot of people said, wait a minute, what do they know about food? But what they really know is distribution and delivery. So it makes a lot of sense, actually. And they can innovate, I think, in really powerful ways because they know who they are at their core and what they are actually trying to do out there.
Yeah. And if you look at both those companies, although they take very different routes to success, both Amazon and Procter & Gamble are companies that, you know, for better or worse, depending on your perspective, stand at kind of arm's length from the short-termist, quarter-to-quarter financial market forces. And that's part of what carves out the space for them to be who they are, is they don't run around chasing their tail every 90 days.
It's exactly what you said earlier about not chasing the competition and not chasing change, which I'm pretty sure that the companies on this list are not doing.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
I will put a link to the show notes to that, to Management Top 250 as well, as a bunch of anything else we talk about. So listeners out there, know you don't have to go look it up. I will put it in the show notes so you can find it immediately. Before I ask you the last question, where can people go to connect and learn more about you and Drucker?
So they can go to our website, which is www.drucker.institute. And that will give you everything you need to know about our work, about the journal rankings, and about the team of people who are behind all this work. It's a pretty small, pretty incredible team. And I just feel hugely grateful and lucky to have the team members I've got doing this work. None of it's possible without them.
So I'm curious, what's in the future for the Drucker Institute? Is there a thing coming up in 2018, 19 that you guys are particularly excited about?
Yeah, we've got a couple of things on the horizon. So one of them is, now that our company rankings have seen the light of day, we're launching two things that have been long in incubation for us. One is a data consulting service around all the research we've done. And the other is an investment product that'll make this kind of holistic, long-term worldview available to the average everyday investor. We're really excited about letting people put their money behind this worldview that Drucker spent, you know, nearly 70 years kind of getting established as the DNA of management. So those are two major initiatives. And then we also have our annual Drucker Prize for Nonprofit Innovation. You know, let's remember, we also work with nonprofits and government agencies too. And social sector innovation is just so vital right now, with just all the turbulence that our society and others are in the midst of. We really need our nonprofits to do all kinds of heroic things. And innovation is how they get that done. So early in 2018, we'll be launching our 2018 application for the $100,000 prize. And it's just an amazing, amazing program. And we get incredible organizations every year that apply. And I always look forward to that. So that's what's on the immediate horizon for us.
Ooh, that's exciting. And, you know, to just, again, go back to what you said in the beginning, whether it's you work in nonprofit, government, or for-profit business, it's all people-based. And you're still trying to deliver something of value to someone who needs it. So whether you come from nonprofit or business. So the last question I have for you is, what's one piece of advice that you would give Launch Streeters on how to lead, just given where we are today in the world?
Yeah, you know, I'll go back to just some good Peter Drucker wisdom. He had a great saying, with great peaks come great valleys. And he wrote that when he was specifically talking about people and particular managers and leaders. And we live in a time today when we all seem to be striving to be nothing but peaks without any valleys. And there's no such thing, as he said. There is no universal Superman or Superwoman. We'll have to make do with human beings the way they are. And as a leader, I think probably the most important thing you can do when you show up for work every day is to be mindful of both what your peaks and your valleys are. To know what those peaks are that are going to be your areas of strength that you can draw on, and to understand and, in fact, be open with your people about what your valleys are, the things you don't do well, the areas where you're not quite competent, the areas of where you have blind spots, and to work with your people to both understand how they can help you with those things. They'll fill in those gaps, but it also creates room for them to be human as well and to focus on their peaks without getting stressed about their valleys and trying to pretend that they don't exist. And as a leader, you set that tone and you make that possible for your whole team.
I love that idea. That is a great piece of advice. I just started reading The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. I don't know if you've seen the book. But the whole premise of it is, hey, look, we're not all our Facebook posts all the time. Let's stop pretending that that's what life really is. To your point, it's peaks and valleys. And sometimes you get it right, and sometimes you don't. And this idea that we always have to have, you know, the perfect life with the best ideas and be on our game and performing at our peak is exhausting.
Yeah.
And not real.
Yeah, I mean, A.G. Lafley was the great leader of Procter & Gamble for many years. He wrote, I loved the line. He just said, I consider my failures a gift. Mm. And man, if you really try, I mean, most of us don't actually treat failures that way. It sounds cool, but we treat failures as things to be shunted off to the side and forgotten as quickly as possible. If we actually treated failures like gift, which meant, you know, we'd all gather around and we'd open up the failure and we'd take a look at it, we'd play with it and think about it and remember it and then put it on the shelf and look at it from time to time, boy, it really changes the relationship we have with those moments. And they are actually where we learn and where often the best ideas and new products and services come from. So to in a non-bullshit way, embrace that is hard. It requires, again, courage, but it's so powerful as a leader to set that tone.
I think was it one of the many Tony Robbins events and books I've read and been to talked about, you know, if you think of it as outcomes, it doesn't matter if it's a failure or final. It's just, what did you learn out of it? And I think to your point, one of the hard, and this could probably be a whole different podcast for us, but one of the hardest challenges that I see in organizations when we go in with innovation in particular, but I think it's across the board, is, you know, we give a lot of lip service to, we love failure, we reward failure, but when it comes to actually doing it, it's a lot harder, and we often fall short of that. We put it on the failure shelf and say, let's just not look at that again.
Yeah, that's right. It is. We love failure is right up there with people are our most important asset.
Right.
One of the I think largest piles of horseshit you can find in any organization, with a few exceptions. And when you find those exceptions, it's really clear. You know, it's clear. Wow, this place actually means it. But most don't. They just know it's the right thing to say.
I have to ask for you and your team. Do you find when you go into work with a team, you know, whether it's for profit, nonprofit, doesn't matter, and they give you their mission statement and it has things like "we love failure, we take risks, our people are our greatest asset," do you immediately go, let's talk a little more about that?
Yeah, it's so hard. I mean, as I'm sure you know, as a instinctual risk taker, right? If I look at my profile, there's a sense in which I want to just kind of grab every issue at once and let's go charge off and kind of tackle the big problems. But again, you got to be watchful. You don't want to make people feel too badly about themselves, and you also don't want to over-optimize things. So often what you want to find is, what's the area that's ready for change, where there's some change that's already trying to happen on its own? Let's work together on that. Maybe we'll get the other thing warmed up and going eventually. But organizations are just like people. They're so rife with things that are in conflict and disagreement with each other, you know, problematic. And
right. And
that's all good in a way. You know, you kind of embrace it as sort of the truth of the place. And, you know, we don't need to – nothing. We're not trying to make a diamond here. We just want to make something that works. And, so you sort of embrace the good and the bad and try to find where it gets interesting.
Well, and I think, you know, it kind of goes back to intent too. Nobody wrote that down thinking, let's put something down we can't live by or won't.
Yeah.
That's not how it goes.
That's a great point. And it can actually be an interesting thing to mine, is to say, well, what was the intent behind that? Where did that come from? What's our history behind that? How did we get to this place?
Well, I have a feeling that instinctual side on your archetype really does help you. That's all about, you know, seeing and connecting the dots and the patterns. And having a little bit more of a circuitous route to getting to kind of innovation and ideas. And I think in the work that you do, that's probably tremendously helpful to all those that come through the Drucker Institute, because I think oftentimes that solution, that idea, that way to solve something isn't an A to B to C. It's A to X to L, over to 1, back to C again.
Yes, yes, it absolutely is. And look, us instinctuals have to be mindful, because every now and then, you know, you say something you think is brilliant and everybody looks at you and says, I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow you. So you're not always on the right path, but sometimes you're absolutely right. It is the windy path that gets you to where you need to go in the end.
Oh my God, I love that you said that. I'll tell you that some of the advice when we do work with clients on it, when people who are instinctuals, we say to them, look, follow your brilliance, say it, and then be prepared to back up.
Yes.
Because people are not going to get it right away because they didn't go A to X to L back to A. So just use it, leverage it for your thinking, and be prepared to take a deep breath and walk people through how you got there.
Yeah, that's right. Don't have too much commitment to your craziness.
That's right. That's the quote. That's the quote of the day right there. Well, Zach, thank you so much for joining me. This has been absolutely fascinating. I got a tremendous amount out of this, and I know our launch treaters will as well.
Thanks, Tamara. It was a real pleasure. I love the conversation. And I wish nothing but the most courage to all the listeners who are engaged in these really difficult questions. But they are the right ones to be thinking about.
Yeah, I love it. I can't believe the interview's over. I know, right? The part about silos and systemic and how innovation fits in leading companies, powerful lessons in this one from Zach First. So now the question becomes, how do I, a launch leader, get more people involved in my ideas so I can create a more scalable and systemic approach to innovation? Well, you guessed it. Get access for you and your team to Innovation On Demand. That's just on our website, so that you can tap the power of the top innovation tools and resources to create a culture of innovation where everyone is accountable for and gets involved in being innovative to solve those challenges and seize the opportunities right in front of them. It's kind of like Zach was talking about. You know, innovation sometimes happens in silos. And if I were to use his language and stories earlier, that's like just having your knee work or your elbow work and the rest of the body's barely chugging along. Well, you get your team Innovation On Demand, the top tools, the empowerment, the accessibility, and the letting them know they're capable of and responsible for innovation, and the entire body works. The entire organization works. So just go to gotolaunchstreet.com and click on the Innovation On Demand to get your access, or reach out to us for team access. We'll put the links in the show notes. All right, Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on gotolaunchstreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. Gotolaunchstreet.com.